And now on BBC World Service, the actor and comedian Lenny Henry presents a portrait of the African-American playwright August Wilson in August Shines.
I've always had this fascination with words, and my mother taught me how to read when I was four. And it was something about the idea that there were these symbols and that you could actually tell someone what you were thinking by using them. I can remember learning the word breakfast and the fact that it was two words, break fast. I was in kindergarten at the time, and I thought, this is wonderful. You can take two words and put them together, and they mean a third word. And I think from that moment, I was gone.
I'm the boss. You understand? I'm the boss around here. I do the only saying what counts.
Come on,
Pa. I ask you, did you understand?
Yeah.
What?
Yes, sir.
Just over a year ago, I was lucky enough to play the leading character, a man called Troy Maxson, in Fences, a piece by the African-American playwright August Wilson. That was an extract from a recent BBC production. Troy is the heart and soul of Wilson's most famous work, which is set in 1950s America. He's an ex-baseball star who falls foul of the law, serves his time, and by the time the play opens, is working as a dustbin man, or in the American vernacular, a garbage truck operative.
I think Troy is a magnificent spirit, no matter what the circumstances of his life. It's his willingness to engage life and to live life with zest and purpose and to live it with as much vividness and force and vibrancy as one can.
Troy Maxson is a fantastic part, a huge part, full of rich, ripe language and passion.
And this is what I discover in the blues, despite the seeming sorrowfulness of the music. It's this great vitality and this great force of life and life affirmation, despite whatever the circumstances are.
In a bakery shop today.
For a long time, I'd been fascinated by the characters Wilson created, from the warp and weft of his own experience growing up in the old American Rust Belt town of Pittsburgh.
I used to collect 78 records that I would buy for 5 cents a piece, and I did this indiscriminately. And one day in my stack of records, there was nobody in town with Baker Street Jelly Roll like mine. It was by Bessie Smith, of course. And I recall I listened to the record 22 straight times, just over, you know. I had never heard anything like it.
Nobody in town can Baker Street Jelly Roll like mine.
Fences is set in the yard of a little wooden house in what used to be the city's most vibrant black district, the Hill.
We're here in the Hill District on Roberts and Bedford Avenue, and we're looking at the house where August Wilson used to live.
Where he grew up.
Where he was raised.
And until he was 13.
Chris Rawson was chief theatre critic of the main Pittsburgh newspaper, the Post-Gazette, and knew August Wilson well. With his colleague from the University of Pittsburgh, Larry Glasgow, Chris introduced me to the playwright's own backyard.
It was one of the nation's great black neighborhoods. Well, one of the nation's great neighborhoods, period. It was a very integrated neighborhood.
As I recall, there was quite a few Syrians, Jews, Italians, and blacks were all sort of mixed together. It was a rather interesting neighborhood.
August is born in 1945, when the Hill was full of people working at the great steel mills along the rivers. I mean, Pittsburgh was the forge with which America won World War II.
So the older part of the building actually is this, which is 1840, something like that.
This is kind of working class life in Pittsburgh. You know, I'm from a working class background, but this is very, very poverty stricken. And at the moment it's overgrown and piles of bricks everywhere and dog waste and greenery that needs to be cut away. This was people living cheek by jowl and refusing to melt into a nice, convenient melting pot.
The two rooms, there was no heat, but one was the kitchen and there was a stove, so the stove would serve as heat, and the other was the bedroom, where the mother, the occasional father, and the 4, 5, 6 children shared a bed or two beds.
Early on, I suspect from the time when I was about 7 or 8, one begins to notice that all of the people who are in positions of authority or in positions of power, whether it's the grocery store, the landlord, the teachers at the school, the bus drivers, the people downtown in the shops and the stores, all these people are white. So one begins to notice that.
If you look at the 10 plays, there are 3 of the plays that are set in backyards, and they are all set in this backyard and 2 other backyards right close to where he grew up.
I've been right here with you, Troy. I got a life too. I gave 18 years of my life to stand in the same spot with you. Don't you think I ever wanted other things? Don't you think I had dreams and hopes? What about my life? What about me? Don't you think it ever crossed my mind to want to know other men? Or that I wanted to lay up somewhere and forget about my responsibilities? Or that I wanted someone to make me laugh so I could feel good? You're not the only one who's got wants and needs, but I held on to you, Troy. I took all my feelings, my wants and needs, my dreams, and I buried them inside you. I planted a seed, and I watched and prayed over it. I planted myself inside you and waited to bloom. And it didn't take me no 18 years to figure out that the soil was hard and rocky and it wasn't never going to bloom.
That was Rose, Troy's wife, as spoken by a young, aspiring actor who's entered the annual August Wilson monologue competition for young African Americans. Wilson was himself mixed race. His father was a white immigrant German baker called Alfred Kittle. His mother, an African-American cleaning woman, Daisy Wilson. Kittle was hardly the doting dad, and Daisy pretty much raised Wilson alone, along with his 5 brothers and sisters. But Daisy was ambitious for the young boy and sent him here to the prestigious Central Catholic High School in Pittsburgh.
I suspect my first real encounter would have been when I was like 14, my encounter with racism. And every day when I would go to school, there would be a note on my desk that said, "Go home, nigger." And that, I think, was my first real encounter with both individual and institutional racism.
He was very light-skinned, but he was darker than most of the other people in his family. So we always knew he was black, but he was always looking to find what did it mean to be black.
Frederick August Kittle. The world knows him as August Wilson, but for me, he was my Uncle Freddie.
Also meeting me outside the scaffolding-clad remnants of Wilson's home on the hill is his niece, Kim Ellis. So had her Uncle Freddie suffered at Central Catholic?
Yes. I mean, there was always a problem, you know, in school, and it was largely around either this idea of black inferiority, which breeds low expectations among people who are in power, even if they're black, or the mythology of white supremacy. So yes, he experienced both of those.
Yeah, and even if you're a little kid and you don't have that vocabulary to describe that experience, you are living it.
Yes.
And would feel the burden of that.
Right, and the thing is that August Wilson was, obviously I wasn't there when he was a child, but it seemed as though he could kind of play and get along with anybody. So I don't even think being the only one or one of the few was the issue. I think it was literally the institutional racism wherein children who were bullying him and calling him the N-word, they were not corrected. And so it became clear that the institution and these individual races, they were empowered, and he was the one disempowered and didn't have a voice. And I do think that those early experiences with racism definitely fueled his rage and his desire for justice.
I went from that school and I went to a public school across the street. The work was quite boring because not a very good school. I had a history teacher who assigned us a paper. So I wrote a 20-page paper on Napoleon, because I was fascinated with what Victor Hugo called Napoleon's will to power. And he called me in after the class. He had an A+, which is the highest grade, and he had an E, which is the lowest. And he said, "I'm going to give you one of these 2 grades." And he wanted me to prove that I had written a paper to him, and I felt the fact that I had put my name on it, I said I wrote it, and I didn't feel that I had to prove to him that I wrote the paper, so I told him, "I don't want to talk to you about this." And so he took the paper and he drew a circle around the E, and he handed me back the paper, and I tore it up and I threw it in his wastebasket, and I walked out of the school, and I never went back, and I was 15 years old.
Well, when you dig deeper into the story, that the teacher was black that did this. It was not a white teacher.
Wilson's biographer, Larry Glasgow.
Often you get the impression that this is racism, but in fact it was a black teacher, and a highly respected black teacher who really worked with black students. And I've talked with this man's widow, and she can remember the incident and said she remembers her husband being bothered by this very bright student who sat in the back of the class and wouldn't do any work and had a bad attitude, and he was trying to figure out a way to reach him.
There's like one thing that he said that always will stay in my mind. Have a belief in yourself bigger than anyone's disbelief. And I was like...
Mm-hmm. That's great. That means you can do anything you want, right? That means you don't have to...
Right.
You don't have to be limited by anybody else's limitations.
For these young black actors, August Wilson is a role model and a beacon.
It kind of feels like I'm at home just to hear people in a play talking like my aunts and uncles and grandfathers would.
Uh-huh. I feel like he captures a, like, a three-dimensional aspect of like what it means to be a man. Like, everyone's flawed, and all of his male figures have been to jail, you know? And I just feel like he makes these heroes out of everyday men.
I'm just tired, Dub. Can't hardly explain it, Dub. You look at one day, and all you got left is what you ain't spent. Every day costs you something, and you don't all the time realize it. I used to question God about everything. Why he hardened Pharaoh's heart? Why he let Jacob steal his brother's birthright? After Corrine died, I told myself I wasn't gonna ask no more questions because the answers didn't matter. They didn't matter right then. I thought that would change, but it never did.
Now, he writes about Pittsburgh and the African Americans within it. Do you recognize these stories? Are these people from around the way? Do you know these people?
I know every single person. I know every single story, every single person. I mean, he delved in magical realism. So some of them are direct, actual stories of my family members who may or may not have different names in the plays. I mean, oftentimes he would assign a name to someone who had a totally different story, but it was meant to honor that person and their legacy in our family. So just sitting around and listening to the stories, they would be laughing about, you know, hey, remember when Uncle Ray pulled his teeth with a pair of rusty pliers? And I knew that ended up
That's
in a play.
Infectious.
I mean, literally, I could look on this street. I mean, Miss Pearl, she lived right there. I mean, right there. It was a tight-knit and well-historied and well-storied family, and all grew up together and in circumstances together, namely poverty and struggling and trying to make it.
Despite walking out of school, August was a gifted writer, a poet, and a voracious reader. He especially devoured the Hill District's Little Library's collection of so-called Negro books. But to find his true voice, and the voices of his characters, he realized he had to get away from Pittsburgh to the Midwestern city of St. Paul, Minnesota.
So I asked my friend Rob Penny, how do you make your characters talk? And he said, you don't, you listen to them. So when I moved to St. Paul, a city of about 10,000 blacks in the entire city, for the first time, being removed from them, for the first time I began to hear the voices that I had grown up with all my life. And I began to discover and recognize their value.
Hello. How are you?
Nice to see you, Lenny Henry from the BBC.
Welcome, Saladin. Come in.
On the other side of the hill, in his beautiful, spacious house and garden, I met one of August's oldest friends and collaborators, the actor turned local politician, Salahuddin.
The characters were absolutely real, and the way they behaved was absolutely real. You had blacks on television who did not act the way we acted at home. Mm-hmm. Bill Cosby and his family, they were not typical of black family. Black families curse, and we dance, and we talk the way we talk. And that was the way August's characters talked also. He was true to the real culture of the working class people that we were.
And they say he had photographic memory, but he could remember things that he had heard and repeat them years later verbatim.
Professor Larry Glasgow again.
And so there was a lot of conversations that he overheard. I've talked to some of his old girlfriends, and they talk about Wilson would take them to, they'd go to a restaurant, like Eddie's restaurant. Wilson would sit in there with his girlfriend, and they would both pay attention to conversations they were overhearing in the next booth. And Wilson would lean over and say, listen to that, listen to that. Isn't that something? Did you hear what he just said? Now this is on a date. You see, this is on a date.
If you didn't get a sock in the jaw.
Pittsburgh is famous for its jazz, in fact, and not the blues. And almost everyone who's anyone either came from here or has performed here.
Today they play at CJ's down by the river, but back when the Hill was the hippest place in town, it had to be the Crawford Grill. Trumpeter Nelson Harrison.
Now the person playing tonight is one of the people who were, we grew up in the grill together. And we were on a bandstand while August was down and writing, and the poets were walking around and all that.
And so August would write at the grill. He would sit in the booth and write.
Every day. Every day, that's what he did. We didn't know what he was writing, but he was writing.
He was writing about you guys.
He was picking up conversations and threads of conversation and stuff like that. And nobody had a clue until he came out with the plays. He was like the NSA, man. He was actually capturing that atmosphere in words. Now, there were four poets, called themselves the Center Avenue Poets. Charlie Williams, Nick Flournoy, Rob Penny, and August. August was the youngest of them.
Charlie, he's a good poet.
Well, yeah, he was writing poetry long before he wrote plays. Rob was the playwright. Rob taught August how to write plays. Actually, they became the Center Avenue Four.
He was a poet and considered himself a poet well up into the 70s, primarily. His hero was Dylan Thomas. He was famous for going around in the Hill. He could recite Dylan Thomas's poems in the Welsh accent on the streets of Center Avenue.
And you guys were all young. Did you feel, as young people often do, that you could change the world?
Absolutely. The poets were the fire breathers. They were the tip of the spear. And theater was even more effective than poetry.
I first got involved in theater in 1968, in the middle of the Black Power movement in the States. And I felt it a duty and honor to participate, as we were, Black Americans were debating the character of our culture and also seeking ways to alter our relationship to the society. So I started with my friend Rob Penny. We started a theater called the Black Horizons Theater. Rob had written a couple plays, and we inaugurated the theater with his plays. And since I was a writer, I went home immediately and tried to write a play. And stumbled. I could not write a play because I couldn't write dialogue.
But advice and support were at hand in the persons of two distinguished men of North American theater, Yale Drama School's director Lloyd Richards and in Minnesota, Claude Purdy, who both shaped the playwright's technique. But by this time, his friend Salah Uddin had quit acting.
August came back in 82 from Minnesota and said, I'm ready to stage my first play. I said, great, good luck with it. He said, no. The main character in the play, I had you in mind as I wrote the character, and I need you to play this role. So I said, well, what's the name of the play? And he said, Jitney. I said, oh, wow, Jitney. Yeah, and that immediately clicked because Jitneys are very Pittsburgh.
So where are we, Chris? What are we looking at?
Well, we're in Wiley Avenue in the heart of the Hill District, and just ahead of us is a building standing all by itself, which is a jitney station, one of six or seven in the Hill District. Jitneys are illegal taxis that service the black areas where the yellow cab and the regularly enfranchised taxis will not go.
And it's like a solo building and next to a grassed-over vacant lot. Just over the road from Big Thomas Barbershop.
And more to the point, you go up about a block and you have the Crawford Grill.
Yes, where Lions gets to play in Fences.
And this is the one that happens to have the same phone number as the Jitney station in the play that August Wilson wrote called Jitney.
I was just talking to Clifford next door. He said the man's gonna board his place up next month.
Yeah, I know. The man from the city was by here 2 weeks ago, too. They're gonna tear it all down, this whole block.
The man was by here and you ain't told nobody. What'd he say?
They're gonna board the place up the first of next month.
Why in the hell didn't you tell somebody?
I'm telling you now.
Find time to tell me 2 weeks later. It ain't like that's a small piece of news. I got rent to pay, doctor bills. Every man in here depending on this station for their livelihood. The city's gonna board it up. You've known for 2 weeks and you ain't bothered to get around to telling nobody?
Pretty run-down building.
Well, of course. And, you know, any day it's going to be, and that's, of course, true of the play. They expect that any day the building is going to be condemned by the city.
I knew that August loved jitney stations.
Because of the atmosphere and the vibe.
Because the jitney drivers and the fun that they had and the lies that they told and the arguments that they would get into. August loved that stuff. Mm-hmm.
And he got a lot of his material from the jitney stations.
We answer the phone, we say, service. They say, I need a car at 205. Okay, where are you going? How many people are there?
Yeah.
Then we'll tell them that's a $5 trip. You call for a car, it's $5 to go anywhere on the hill. That's the board that we try to go by.
And you can't jump the line?
No. He'll say, next man, anybody want this trip? Or the next man. Okay. Excuse me, 1 minute. Hello? Yes. East Liberty?
For me, as beginning playwright, it was a perfect setting because whenever you got stuck, you could always bring a new character in or take one off, or, you know, whenever I wasn't sure where I was going with the dialogue, the phone would ring and it would start something new.
A lot of cussing and messing with one another. We chide one another all day long. If you have a thin skin, don't come in here. Don't come in here if you got a thin skin, because they will get on your ass.
So when August said, name of the play is Jitney, wow, that's great, man. When I read it, tears were coming down my face.
Because it was funny? Because it was
moving? No, because it was so meaningful.
He sort of publicly rejected the classical European theatre model. He famously talks about not watching Chekhov or Shakespeare in favour of what he sees as the natural African tradition of African Americans. Do you agree?
Absolutely. You yourself are particularly identified with Fences, which was one of his least favorite plays.
Critic and academic Chris Rawson.
Fences was his attempt to write a play that the white critics would recognize as a play because it has this huge commanding central character.
Yes.
They were really buffaloed by Ma Rainey and by Joe Turner's Come and Gone. These are plays where you spend half the play with people talking. You don't know what the story is. You don't know who the central character is. And August loved that because eventually, out of that potpourri of stuff, the story gradually emerges. He called that African. He called that tribal. That seemed to him his tradition.
There's something that is part of the blood's memory. You know, there's a sensibility that is still, despite the fact that we've been in North American continent for 370 years, something like that, there's still this Africanness. You see, we walk down the street different. There's a certain style. We decorate our houses different. And the way we view life, our worldviews are different. And these are things that have survived for hundreds of years. So I'm saying the culture is very much alive.
At the end of Fences, Troy's brother Gabriel goes into a strange, transformative trance which stems directly from Wilson's desire to uncover the deep Africanness of African Americans. This theme runs like blood throughout August Wilson's amazing corpus of work, his life's achievement, the so-called Pittsburgh Cycle. They're 10 great plays that narrate the African-American experience through memorable characters and their stories. And it's told in the rich vernacular Wilson overheard at the Crawford Grill and hanging out in the drugstores and dives of the Hill. The 10-play cycle, part magical and a long way from the European model of the well-made play, is set in 10 separate decades of the 20th century. For instance, there's Joe Turner's Come and Gone, telling the story of the great black migration north of the early century. The Piano Lesson, set in the 1930s, two trains running in the 1960s, right up to the century's last decade with Radio Golf. Chris Rawson.
And it's interesting that he didn't start out to do that. Ma Rainey is set in the 20s, and then the second play was Fences, basically set in the 50s, and then the third is Joe Turner, which is 1911. And he looked at that and he thought, well, they're each in a different decade. Why don't I make that my plan? I mean, the first play appeared in 1984 and he died in 2005. And he died as he just finished Radio Golf, which is the 1990s play. I mean, nobody else did it.
August Wilson died on October the 2nd, 2005, age 60. Salah Uddin and his friends organized a great ceremonial funeral at which trumpeter Wynton Marsalis appeared unannounced to send the great man off to the tune of Danny Boy.
And then at the end of the last note of Danny Boy, he reaches into his back pocket, pulls out a white handkerchief and started waving the handkerchief and started playing, "Oh, when the saints go marching in, oh, when the saints go marching in," and starts a parade line.
So it was like a New Orleans style.
It was a New Orleans second line march.
Close friends and family then repaired downtown to Pittsburgh's venerable Oyster House restaurant, where the playwright used to love to eat fish sandwiches and earwig the conversation. And for the wake, August had personally prescribed Crown Royal whiskey, sweet potatoes with marshmallows and cookies.
I think he'll be remembered as a Pittsburgh playwright who really wrote about things from the city and about the city in a way that was so profound that it resonates with people in other cities in the United States and even around the world. The sorts of things that they grapple with may, on the surface, seem very unique and special to black people in Pittsburgh, but there's also a universal quality to the sorts of problems they wrestle with that people can relate to.
The theme that I keep coming back to over and over again, and that is the need to reconnect yourself. There's no sense of that I'm standing in my grandfather's shoes. You see, and I think if we had that, and this is what, simply what I'm trying to do with my plays, is to make that connection, because I think it's vital. Having shared a common past, we have a common future. We also have a common present.
August Shines was presented by Lenny Henry and produced by Simon Helms.